There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to the latest edition of The Other Hand. Good to see you, Jim. I just wanted to remark on our most recent podcast with journalist Sarah Carey. What a reaction we've got to that. And we've got more comments after one day than we've had for many a podcast, actually. All of them favourable. I wasn't sure whether everybody would agree with everything that we said on the pod, but most people did, which was gratifying. We've not received any abusive texts, emails, or tweets, or exes, or whatever they're called these days. So well done, Sarah, and a big thank you to her for participating. And it tells me, Jim, something that I think both of us have suspected for some time, that despite the coverage in the mainstream media and in various other podcasts and the like, there is still a huge appetite for political coverage of Ireland, political discussion, political analysis of things Irish in a way that isn't done. I wouldn't be so self-aggrandizing to say that we're filling a hole in the market, but I think we've identified that there is a hole, and that what we're going to do with Sarah, hopefully, and people like Sarah and ourselves over the course of at least the next year in the run-up to the general election, try and fill that gap. So watch this space.
If I may just say, I've known Sarah for many years. I've always been a fan. I think her analysis is fantastic. It's very balanced. It's very grounded. Like yourself, I have got a lot of feedback personally about just this podcast in a very, very positive way. So I think we should formally thank Sarah, and I look forward to having her on again.
So moving on to today's agenda, I want to start with a very brief discussion about economics in general and one particular part of economics that is of relevance to absolutely everybody. I would say this, wouldn't I, that all of economics is relevant, but not everybody would necessarily agree with that. There was a what's called a seminal paper published in 2016 by some MIT economists. One of them was David Autor, and it was all about something called the China shock. Now, Jim, you would remember back in short trousers what you were taught about free trade. In three bullet points or less, what are young economists and indeed politicians, policymakers taught about free trade? What's the soundbite that we always hear?
I think it all goes back to the law of comparative advantage, that countries should specialize in what they're good at, where they have a competitive advantage, and basically trade the rest. And that when trade happens, that everybody is a winner.
That's all true, Jim, but you've been an economist for too long. What I was hoping you'd say would give me the soundbite that even newspaper journalists have heard, which is free trade is good.
Well, that's exactly what I said, Chris.
I know, Jim. Yeah, but
everybody benefits. Okay, free trade is good.
Yes, free trade is good. And we're brought up on that. Our DNA is modified to believe that. And we recoil in horror at things like tariffs, things like import controls. One of the things that I grew up with when I was just out of short trousers was there was something called the Cambridge Economic Policy Group, which advocated import controls to solve the UK's economic problems back in the early and mid-1970s. And the economics profession recalled with horror at these professional economists advocating import controls, and they were never tried, and these people were shouted down and are now ancient history. But this paper that I reference, which dates back only a few years to 2016, has caused quite a stir in the ensuing years, but really only in the profession. And I don't think it's really seeped out into the wider world for a number of reasons. It deals with what's called the China shock, and it shows that China's accession to the World Trade Organization was directly responsible for vast swathes of manufacturing industry, particularly in the United States, being absolutely eviscerated. And we all know what that led to. These kind of studies are always very tricky, always very controversial. And it probably is an oversimplification to say that it caused an awful lot of economists to rethink that basic thing that's ingrained into them, that free trade is good. But it has caused us to rethink. We're not quite sure anymore. And I'm reminded, and this is a piece of economics, that one of the things about the free trade is good thing is that there's an assumption underlying all of the models that produce that, including that one that you mentioned there of comparative and absolute advantage, in that lurking somewhere in all models that say free trade is good is an assumption. And there's nothing wrong with assumptions. All models, economic and otherwise, are based on them. But it assumes something about employment, and in particular, full employment. And that's a key weakness. And economists have always known this, way before this paper was published by David Auter et al. And one of the reasons why economists have never jumped up and down and admitted loudly, they do it sotto voce, they do it quietly, that free trade produces both winners and losers, is that they're frightened of the political response to the loser thing. And it leads to things like people saying we should have import controls, we should protect domestic industries. There's an assumption that the net benefits of free trade the benefits outweigh the cost. So net free trade is a positive, and that somehow or other the people who are losers end up getting jobs, end up getting something or other compensated in some way for the fact that they've lost out. But the China shock, China coming into the world trading system, the equivalent of a small planet being discovered just off the Earth's atmosphere, in which there are a billion people willing to work for 50 cents an hour, was a massive shock. And some people trace the line between that shock, that evisceration of manufacturing jobs in places like the United States, to the rise of Donald Trump, to Brexit, to populism. And some people might argue with that, but I think there is a strong case for arguing that. And I was taken by something I read published by the IMF, that establishment economics organization, this week, in which a whole bunch of economists were looking at the state of economics. And there's a Nobel Prize winner called Angus Deaton, who, in a completely different context, coined that classic term, deaths of despair, when looking at opioid addiction in the United States and what that has done to communities in that and indeed other countries. But he was talking about the state of economics generally. And one of the things that he referenced was this belief in free trade that he himself, as a much older economist now, has gone back to revisit and is rethinking. And I think a lot of us are doing that very carefully. And the reason why we do it carefully is that political point is that politicians will take this idea and run in completely the wrong direction with it. But that's a different story for another day.
One second. How do you mean run in the wrong direction? I mean, if free trade gives rise to increased inequality, a lot of losers...
Yeah, absolutely. The wrong direction is to start to do things like start trade wars and heavily protect the wrong industries and pick winners and do all sorts of politically stupid things that make a bad situation worse.
Hold on, Chris. Hold on a second. If you're sort of saying that free trade is bad.
I said that core belief that free trade always and everywhere is a good thing is being called into question. We're not quite sure what's replacing that core belief. What's replacing that core belief is not a belief that free trade is always and everywhere bad. I think we're realizing something that we've always known deep down, but been frightened to confront because of the political consequences of confronting this basic truth, is that free trade, the consequences of free trade vary through time, depend on the starting circumstances of the economy that you're talking about, depend on how much unemployment there is. When a China comes along and your economy is at full employment, and in fact you're short of workers, the effects on your economy of admitting China into your trading system, giving them free access to your market, is going to be much different to when your economy is in recession and lots of unemployment. So it all depends. How bad free trade is or how good free trade is depends on so many different things. It isn't that simplistic thing that it's always and everywhere a really, really good thing. It all depends. And I'm certainly not saying it's a bad thing. What I'm saying, it's horses for courses, Jim. So in the case of the China shock, they shouldn't have allowed it into the free trading system in the way that they did. They should have done something different. They shouldn't have slapped on 60% Trump-style tariffs that he's threatening now. That's not what this means. It doesn't necessarily mean that what he did was right with the 10% tariff, which he actually did. It requires deep thought, deep analysis, and a nuanced set of policies instead of this knee-jerk, well, if it's not good, it must be bad.
Let me clarify. You were saying you discovered this planet with a billion people who are prepared to work for virtually nothing, okay?
50 cents an hour.
Yeah, and if that happens in an environment of full employment in, say, the United States, that the consequences are muted, whereas that if it happens in an environment of recession, the consequences are much more serious. Is that the logic? Yeah,
yes.
Okay. And surely, I guess, and this brings in the whole debate about globalization, you know, going back to the stuff that Thomas Friedman wrote years ago about globalization, about the butterfly fluttering its wings in China and causing a tsunami in the United States or wherever it was at the time. But rather than clamping down on free trade, I think you kind of have to accept it as a given, provided you put mechanisms in place to make sure that those workers who are displaced are actually looked after, retrained, financially compensated, whatever.
If that had been done,
the rise in inequality would have been significantly more limited than it has turned out to be. And does that make an argument, Chris, for the introduction of a basic universal payment?
There's a lot going on there. But in terms of the China shock, let me tell you a different story. You probably did the same thing as me. I once, when I was working for a large Irish bank, gave a presentation in Rochester, New York State, upstate New York, where there were a number of, back in the 90s, big US manufacturing companies. I won't say which ones, because, well, they're gone now, aren't they? One was Kodak, actually, the maker of film. And Kodak is an example of a company that wasn't eviscerated by China. It was eviscerated by technological change, the advent of digital cameras. But there was another big manufacturing company. I won't mention its name because it still does exist, I think. But it made a lot of things like sunglasses and spectacles and lenses and things like that. And I was asked a very specific question. This was the day that was in it, because at the time, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was being negotiated between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And listen to the answer that I gave at that talk, Jim. You might have even been there. I don't know whether you were with me or not. But the answer I gave to the question at this talk was that, as an economist, I am genetically modified to believe that free trade is good. The thing that worries me about NAFTA is that it's too much change too quickly. It's going to eviscerate too many US manufacturing jobs overnight because of all of the Mexican factories that are going to be producing cars that are now currently produced in Detroit. I think free trade in theory and in practice is mostly a good thing, but you have to introduce the changes slowly enough that your country, your economy, and your society can absorb them, that you can do the things that Jim Power has just mentioned there by, like, retraining and compensating, all the rest of it. But if you do it overnight, you're going to create economic problems for sure, and also social problems that flow from these economic problems. So I think one of the issues in the answer to the question, how much free trade is a good thing, is that it's always a good thing, but too much of it too quickly just produces too much instability. And you produce those butterfly effects where you have these incredibly non-linear mathematical effects on your economy and society that take you in a direction that you never expected. If the changes of this planet called China, with a billion workers willing to work 50 cents an hour, had been introduced over 20 years rather than 20 minutes, which effectively it was, the outcome might have been very different. And US industry might have adapted in ways that it wasn't allowed to in the first place. So what I'm saying is that this is a pretty fundamental part of economics, of the way in which economists are raised from short trousers, as I say, to having a rethink. It is interesting in that volume produced by the IMF this week, there was another piece written by a Cambridge economist, Cambridge UK economist called Professor Diane Coyle, talking about the way in which economics has to change pretty fundamentally, not just in this area of thinking about free trade, but an awful lot of the edifice upon which economics was built in the 1950s, 60s and 70s has just gone. Because back in those days, you know, economies were some produced things that you could measure, that you could weigh. And she wrote a book once called The Weightless Economy. And that's what she's going on about there, is that the modern structure of economies, economics hasn't caught up. I don't want to make this whole podcast about the economics profession, because the most important thing I think there is that discussion about free trade. Because as I say, even business journalists with the lightest training of economics know the mantra free trade is good. But I just wonder, Jim, whether people who've heard that mantra before realize just how nuanced and how much of it is being rethought by the economics profession.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I remember when Trump... prior to 2016 election was running with this notion that or the claim that it was the North American Free Trade Agreement caused all of the job losses in the United States, the blue collar job losses. And one of the retorts to that was that actually technology and technological development had a much more significant impact than free trade agreements. So, you know, the ability of technology to discard workers is quite dramatic. I grew up on a farm where there was a lot of people working, producing very little. Today, that farm is incredibly productive with two or three people basically running it. And that's largely down to technology. So how do you build technology into this whole debate?
Well, that's the theory working out in practice. That's the actual development of economies working out as the theory of free trade and growth suggests, which is that when you have workers that are displaced from industries that are either replaced by machines or replaced by workers overseas, they simply find other jobs, which is the history of Ireland. Ireland has more jobs today than it's ever had in its history, but it's never had as few agricultural workers. If you go back not a very long period of time, Jim, the majority of workers, majority in Ireland, were all working on the land. And those workers or their descendants have all found other jobs. That's the way in which these things work in textbook fashion. But just imagine Ireland if technological change had, say, in the 1950s, when the majority of people were still working on the land, and Intel and Apple and Microsoft had suddenly fetched up on the banks of the Liffey. The structural changes that the Irish economy has undertaken have been painful enough. I just wonder if you'd suddenly produced, if those companies had produced a whole bunch of machines that enabled all those farms to work with 90% less workers overnight, what would Ireland look like today? You know, the changes were wrenching enough as they were, but the changes in Irish, the two graphs, non-agricultural and agricultural employment, are very, very stark over the last number of decades in Ireland. If they'd been even quicker, what kind of society would we have now? So in a way, it's the speed of change that I think people react to as much as anything else. Because I think as human beings, we can only take so much change. But anyway, it's interesting to see that a lot of the core beliefs that we were raised with, or some of them anyway, are being questioned and not rejected, but perhaps are becoming more nuanced. And the important substantive point for the future, which is one of the things that affects us all, is that economists have recognized that the China shock was a real challenge to the theory of free trade and raised lots of questions, as I say. But at least we comforted ourselves that it could only happen once, didn't we, Jim? You could only have one China shock after all.
I was just going to say that there's another one happening now.
Tell us about it.
So, I mean, how do you think the current Chinese shock is going to impact?
Well, there are a number of aspects to this. The first thing is that Xi Jinping has a fondness for manufacturing. He's got a thing for it. He's got a fetish for it, if you like. He believes that Chinese economic development has been based on manufacturing, and that getting him out of his current economic hole has got to be based on manufacturing as well, and high-end manufacturing in particular, things like chips and other high-tech goods. And by all accounts, he's planning a second China shock for the world. The thing that went along with it the first time, which was destabilizing of our societies and the rise of populism because so many people got left behind too quickly, that was a bonus for China because they do have a vested interest in destabilizing the West. And it seems that he's going to be very happy to try and do it again this time around, partly because we know about the economics from that one seminal paper from 2016 that we reacted to it very poorly the first time around. And I think there's just generally so much anti-China sentiment around at the moment because we're more aware of what they're up to with surveillance and espionage and all other sorts of nefarious activities around the world. I don't think that they'll get away with it in quite the way they did the first time around, but who knows?
That whole relationship with China, United States, China, the United Kingdom, China, Europe, China, is going to be fundamentally destabilizing because at the end of the day, there is a limit to what the UK, the US, Europe can do in the face of this Chinese threat, because China is still the world's second largest economy. And if you cause serious dislocation economically, the political ramifications of that, it's going to be an incredibly difficult relationship to manage. And Rishi Sunak is struggling with it big time at the moment, I would have thought. Chris, I was smiling there when you were talking about chip manufacturing in China. On a lighter note, did you see a story about an MP, I presume it was a Tory, who is, he's trying to get a chipper opened in Uxbridge.
Oh, yeah.
And Uxbridge is a town that I spent a fair bit of time in my earlier working life. Never knew there wasn't a chipper there, but he's running this campaign to get a chipper. Have you read that?
No, I haven't seen that story, Jim. Uxbridge is Boris Johnson's old constituency, of course.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Chris, this is something I think we will keep returning to. There's no doubt about it. Can I just turn a little bit to closer to home here in Ireland? I produced a report last week for the Irish Tourism Industry Confederation looking at the impact of government-induced changes on the tourism and hospitality sector. And on the 1st of January this year, there was a 12.4% increase in the minimum wage. By 2026, the government has a target of introducing a basic living wage, which is 60% of median incomes. And that would translate into around €15 per hour from €12.70 at the moment. And in 2026, that living wage will replace the national minimum wage. So that's one increase, 12.4% on the 1st of January, more to come. Autumn enrollment in pension schemes that legislation is proceeding through the Dáil at the moment. That's another cost to business. We've had changes to statutory sick pay, increasing the number of days that employers have to pay staff who are sick. We saw the PRSI rate for employers increased in the budget last October. So there's a lot of state-induced cost increases for business coming down the tracks. And I estimated based on data, based on wage levels, that the wage bill in the tourism and hospitality sector would increase by around €456 million this year because of those measures alone, and that by 2026, around €1.4 billion. And I wasn't arguing that these initiatives were bad. Increasing wages, particularly for lower paid workers, is a social good. Auto enrollment, I think, is a good idea. So a lot of this stuff is positive. I'm not saying it's not positive, but it goes back to the point you make about when all of this significant change happens very quickly, struggling SMEs are being hit with this cost burden at the moment, okay? Today, the trade union movement here came out with a response to those sorts of arguments, saying that labour market reforms are modest and that, you know, business owners and employers were totally exaggerating the impact of those. Ismay came out and said that while the unions might describe the changes as modest, the open market has decided otherwise. And this morning, reflecting that point, PwC published data on business insolvencies. And in the first quarter of this year, business insolvencies were up by 4.1%. SMEs accounted for 85% of the business failures. Hospitality and retail accounted for 40% of those insolvencies, with the hospitality sector three times greater than the retail sector. So here we have real data on insolvencies backing up an argument that the state-induced costs are imposing significant burden on SMEs. And as I said there, I wasn't saying that these changes were bad, and socially they're very desirable. But when you hit businesses with this raft of cost increase overnight, I think the businesses affected need to be compensated some way, to be honest.
Can I play devil's advocate for a minute here and try and, only to try and tease out the issues? Start at a helicopter level. You know, we're going to take a big picture issue here. Ireland, as you and I have both said in many different contexts, has one of the most redistributive tax and welfare systems in the world. After tax and welfare changes, it has one of the highest equality measures in the world, correct?
Yeah, correct.
One of the responses that you might make to that simple statement of fact, that is not opinion, is that it reveals or conceals actually a problem, which is that pre-distribution incomes in Ireland, before we have welfare and tax changes doing the magic that they do, we have very high, relative to other countries, called market inequality. Yeah. Our wages are actually low, and your take-home pay relative to other countries has a lot of inequality in it, and you need the tax and welfare system to do it. And one of the arguments that's made is that the tax and welfare system is doing too much of the work, and that more of the work should be done at the wage level, and we should simply be paying lower paid people more. And then the response comes back from the Irish companies, SMEs in particular, where a lot of these low paid people are, is that, as you're saying in a different way just there, we haven't got the revenues to do it. The response that an economist might make then is, okay, well, stop being so inefficient, stop being so unproductive. There are SMEs just like you in other countries that are able to pay these wages. Why can't you? If you haven't got the wherewithal to pay these people proper wages, I use that term in inverted commas, it must be because somewhere there's inefficiency or unproductive processes in the system. What's so special about Irish wages that are different to others? So this argument bounces backwards and forward. I'll pause there and ask you for any comments about any or all of that.
Okay, if you look at the hospitality sector, and this is the sector that's most adversely affected by these changes because it's labour intensive and the workers are relatively low paid compared to other sectors of the economy. But those businesses, and I've seen the accounts for restaurants, margins are incredibly tight. So I'm not sure what you can do to improve efficiency in a restaurant, for example, because you need a certain number of waiters, you know, you need a certain number of chefs and so on to serve customers. But the only way these restaurant owners, I think, in general, could pay these higher wages is by increasing the price of the product for the consumer. And I hear people coming back from countries like Spain, Portugal, arguing that, you know, it was so cheap to eat out there. And my response to that is, but did you ask the person serving you how much they're getting paid? And if we paid those sorts of wages here in this country, we could be really cheap as well. So it's I think it's a challenging argument. But I guess one of the points I would make is that when you see a number of government initiatives that are socially beneficial imposing a massive cost burden on a specific sector, there is something unfair about that, in my view. Chris, if you think about countries where hospitality workers are paid well, I was in Belgium last year, and I remember offering the, when I was paying, putting in a gratuity, it was turned down. We don't accept gratuities. We pay our staff enough. You look at the United States, the whole tipping system is now being used to significantly compensate low-paid workers. I'm all over the place here, but I saw a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald recently who said that the ultimate sign of a high intelligence was being able to hold opposing views on the same subject simultaneously. I'm not saying I'm intelligent, but yeah. I'm certainly holding opposing views here at the same time.
You are, Jim. You're all, as you, your own words there, you're all over the place here. What I thought you were going to say is that it must be a matter of data, that you must be able to, in principle, if the data was available, and answer that question about the productivity of these particular sectors of the economy and be able to say, well, the productivity of the restaurant sector in Ireland is X and the productivity of the restaurant sector in Portugal is Y. And the differences are as follows. And you could then start to break things down between wage costs and non-wage costs. And I thought what you were going to say is that the non-wage cost thing for the SME sector, for hospitality in particular in Ireland, is burdensome relative to places like Portugal and Spain and indeed other countries. I don't know whether that's the case or not, but I thought that that was where you would go with your answer, that we have more of these non-wage costs. And it's not just the government-imposed ones. It is the ones the government could have something to do with. For example, you could argue that property costs, insurance costs, legal costs, the charges that your accountant makes are all far too high in Ireland for various structural and other reasons. And that's what you know, a proper investigation of this would look at every single element of the profit and loss statement of one of these companies and say, well, this is the issue here. These are the drivers, and these are the ones that we can do something about. These are the ones that we can't do something about. And one overarching comment is that I suspect if you look at the cost statement of any SMEs, every bloody line is too high relative to the Portuguese and the Spanish equivalent. It's not just wages, it's everything. And yes, government is loading costs onto these businesses, and it's a problem. And I do know people I respect who are leaders in the SME sector are tearing their hair out over these. It's straight costs, but it's also regulatory issues as well. Yeah. And and I think one of the arguments, a bit like the one I was making for trade, is it's too much too quickly. And I think that's always a relevant point to make about managing change. So I'm not sure how far we've got with this, Jim, actually, in terms of my...
No, I'm not sure either. I guess I was having a go at the claims being made by the trade union movement this morning in terms of trying to downplay the impact of those changes. All of those changes I mentioned actually feed directly through to wage costs. Okay, and for many restaurants that I've come across, certainly, and it varies, of course, from business to business, but wage costs typically account for around 40% of total costs. So wage costs are an incredibly important part. But I agree with your point as well about non-wage costs are also significantly higher here than in, you know, other cheaper countries. And that does have an impact as well. I suppose where this is going really, Chris, is recognizing the challenges facing the SME sector that I certainly have harped on about for a long time. It's a tough, challenging world. There is no doubt about that. And I would like to see SMEs treated with a bit more respect and consideration.
Indeed. Hear, hear. I believe, well, we're running out of time now, but there was a whole raft of data that you wanted to have a quick look at as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, out of Europe today, we've had Eurozone bank lending stagnant. We have wage inflation easing in the euro area. So that the argument building up for an interest rate move by the European Central Bank. My view has been that in the second half of the year, it's going to start happening. Yesterday, we had the ESRI come out with a pretty upbeat assessment of Ireland this year and next year. It's and I guess the significant piece here is that it has upgraded its forecast compared to last December. And I think that's reflecting something we've discussed, that the global economic momentum is a little bit stronger than was expected. And I think this is feeding through. But modified domestic demand here forecast to grow by 2.3% this year, 2.5% next year. Unemployment averaging 4.3% this year. It's at 4.2% at the moment in February. and 4.2% average next year. So the labour market remaining incredibly tight. And the basis for, the real basis for the better than previously forecast outlook for the Irish economy this year is that wage growth is going to exceed inflation by about 2% this year. And for somebody earning 40 grand, that would translate into around 950 euro per week. Okay, per year, in real wage gains per year, that is. They're talking about lower interest rates, lower inflation, strong labour market, and a rebound in the export sector following the readjustment we've seen over the last couple of years post-COVID. So generally, this is a pretty upbeat assessment of the Irish economy over the next couple of years. And before you say it, Chris, these are just economic forecasts. And we have discussed ad nauseum how dangerous and foolhardy economic forecasting is in the first place. Another point I would like to make is that on the 1st of April, we're going to see petrol prices increasing by 4 cents a litre, diesel by 3 cents a litre, because of the reversal of the next element of the excise duty cut that was implemented a year ago to help with the cost of living crisis. And the final reversal of that will happen in August. And when those excise savings were introduced a year ago, they took 20 cent off the price of petrol and 15 cent off the price of diesel. So this is being gradually rolled back, but it will feed through to the cost of living situation. And next week, mobile phone TV services are going to be increased by between 2 and 8 euro per month, depending on the company you're with. So there's still cost of living pressures running through the system.
Yeah, and thankfully the domestic cost of electricity and gas will be coming down in the weeks and months ahead, thanks to the behaviour on world markets. So that there are swings and roundabouts here, but a lot of these administered prices, as we used to call them, look like they're going up. I know my own mobile phone bill has gone up a lot this year. So there's still a lot of incipient inflation in the system, and it takes me all the way back, that comment, to my view that we are going to be disappointed by the extent of rate cuts this year, Jim, because I think that central banks are minded to keep things tight because of some of the inflation pressures that you've just mentioned there and others. And it's also the case that I'm going around thinking that the new normal for sort of neutral interest rates, if you like, if you thought when economies are trundling along at whatever economic growth rate they're supposed to be doing, and that there's a little bit of inflation underneath that, where should interest rates be? And where interest rates are, I suspect the answer is not too far from there. If it's down underneath that, it's not by very much. So I think that my views on interest rates are changing, evolving, and not just in the United States, but also in the UK and Europe. Yeah, I think there'll be cuts this year, but I wouldn't start spending them just yet if I was a borrower.
Okay, Chris, listen, we will leave it there. We'll talk again next week. I'll be live from God's country down in Waterford. And have a good Easter. And you sent me a link yesterday to an article in the New York Times about Australia. That's one I think we should start the next podcast off on, because one of the quotes out of that was that Sydney is in danger of becoming a city with no grandchildren. So let's explore that. I think it's really interesting. Have a good one.
Cheers, Jim.